The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
Police in Ottawa sweep in to clear anti-vaccine mandate demonstrators. Plus, regulators expand their probe into Activision Blizzard's handling of harassment claims. And a year after winter weather crippled Texas's power grid, America's electricity network is as unreliable as ever.
It is likely that outages are going to increase in frequency, and they're very likely to be longer in duration. We're already beginning to see that.
It's Friday, February 18th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We're exclusively reporting that Activision Blizzard is the target of expanded federal and state investigations over how the video gaming company handled workplace misconduct claims. Sources say California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing has subpoenaed Activision's directors, as well as LA area police departments, for records related to longtime CEO Bobby Kotick and 18 other current and former Activision employees. The SEC has sent an additional subpoena to Activision in connection with an investigation it launched last year into the company's handling of sexual harassment allegations. Activision has said it is cooperating with the SEC probe and has disputed California's claims. The probes come amid Microsoft's $75 billion takeover of Activision. Experts say if the government investigations aren't resolved before the deal closes, Microsoft would have to take them on. Police in the Canadian capital, Ottawa, are beginning to make arrests as they attempt to end 3 weeks of demonstrations against the country's COVID-19 mandates. Ottawa's interim police chief, Steve Bell, says those involved would face severe penalties if they don't leave.
To those engaged in the unlawful protest, if you want to leave under your own terms, now is the time to do it. We've been really clear with everyone since the very beginning. It's time to go. Your time in our city has come to an end and you must leave.
Meanwhile, Canadian banks have begun to cut off financial services to people linked with ongoing protests after this week's emergency order asked banks to crack down on demonstrators. The U.S. Senate has passed a stopgap funding bill, narrowly averting a government shutdown. Last night's resolution keeps the government funded until March 11th. The vote ended a drama that started when some Republicans threatened to delay passage until the Senate held amendment votes on policy priorities. Meanwhile, the Senate has unanimously passed legislation requiring Supreme Court justices and federal judges to post reports about their stock trades and financial holdings online. The bill now heads to the House, which passed similar legislation in December. It comes after a Wall Street Journal investigation last year found that more than 130 judges broke the law by hearing cases in which they reported having a financial interest. And the Department of Justice has appointed its first ever crypto enforcement leader. Longtime cybercriminal prosecutor Eung-Young Choi has been tapped to direct the agency's National Cryptocurrency Enforcement Team, which aims to investigate and prosecute the criminal misuse of virtual currency and recover the illicit proceeds from those crimes. The FBI also said this week it's creating a dedicated unit to track those same cases. A massive container ship packed with thousands of cars on their way to the U.S. from Germany is today on fire and adrift in the Atlantic Ocean. All its crew have been rescued, but its cargo remains in question. And this comes as the latest snapshot of container activity, the workhorses of global trade, offers worrying signs about the supply chain crisis. Joining us with more on that outlook is Journal reporter Jason Douglas. Jason, what's the latest? What story are shipping containers telling us right now?
If we look at the productivity part of it first, there's a couple of different ways to measure it. The one that I like and lots of people in the industry like is how long it takes for a container to get from the exporters all the way to the person who's actually importing it in the destination country. And if we think about one of the biggest trade routes, which is from Asia, from China in particular, to the west coast of the United States, before the pandemic, that used to take about 45 days. The latest figure we have is that's taking 112 days. So it's more than twice the pre-pandemic length of time. And on prices for shipping containers around the world, just went on an absolute tear during the pandemic and just haven't really come down at all in any significant way. So for a 40-foot container, the figures that we were quoted are around $15,000 to $20,000 to send one of those from China to the US. That used to be pre-pandemic about $2,000. So the cost of global trade, if you like, has really increased.
And how does this outlook compare with previous forecasts about where the supply chain might be now come February 2022?
Shipping containers are telling us basically that the supply chain problems that are bedeviling the global economy still aren't really getting any better. If anything, they might be getting ever so slightly worse. People and I are a little bit pessimistic that we're going to see much of a resolution of this year at all. Previously, there was some hope towards the end of last year that some of these kinks would iron themselves out in the first half, but now it's looking less and less likely.
And looking ahead, what signs should we be keeping an eye out for that these shipping-related supply chain issues might be starting to ease?
I think there have been a few signs towards the end of last year that things were improving, that the length of time it was taking containers to get around the world was coming down, the containers were becoming more productive, and the prices, if they weren't necessarily falling outright, they were certainly appeared to be stabilizing for a lot of the main shipping routes around the world. It appears that was a bit of a mirage. For example, a couple of the big ports in the United States, for instance, were asking container ships to stay away, to stay a little bit further out, which may have given people the impression that the congestion at these ports was easing. But anyway, it looks like those things just haven't really panned out. There's a bit of a hope and an expectation that as interest rates rise in the US, as inflation bites and pandemic restrictions ease, then people will start spending money and going to restaurants and that kind of thing instead of buying electronics and sitting at home with them. But there's just so much congestion at ports, shipping industry folks say that it's just going to take a hell of a long time to work all this stuff out.
That was Journal reporter Jason Douglas. Jason, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, disruptions to the US power grid are becoming more frequent, longer lasting, and more costly with each passing year. And we've got the story on why this problem isn't likely to go away anytime soon after the break.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
A year ago this week, a winter storm knocked out Texas's electricity grid, leaving millions powerless for days and officials struggling to make sense of the immensity of the crisis on their hands.
These are not rolling blackouts. These are power outages at a huge, unprecedented scale.
It's not just cold. It's bitter cold. It's unbelievably miserable.
We had generators throughout the system. And they did not start because the temperatures were too cold for the generators to start.
Texans do not want to go through this again.
But a year later, that situation no longer looks as unique as it once did. And as the Journal's Catherine Blunt reports, issues with the U.S. power grid are likely to get worse before they get better. Catherine joins us now with more. Hi, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So what factors are causing the U.S. electrical system to be, as you write, less dependable as time passes?
The first big factor is that the grid is quite old. I mean, there are parts of it that were built before World War II, and a lot of power lines have been in place for decades. And so naturally, as this equipment reaches the end of its useful life, it becomes more vulnerable to failure. Now, that vulnerability is exacerbated by issues that we're seeing related to climate change, with more frequent storms, storms with greater intensity, and just anomalous weather patterns across the country. So putting further strain on infrastructure that might already be vulnerable to failure. And then there's a third factor, which is that the grid is undergoing an enormous transformation right now. In many, many parts of the country, you are seeing a very quick transition to renewable energy in the form of large wind and solar farms in response to concerns about climate change as we push very hard to shift our generation mix to emissions-free sources of electricity. And that creates a challenge because, you know, these sources by nature are intermittent. They produce power when the sun shines or when the wind blows. unlike, you know, a more conventional power plant that's fired with coal or natural gas that can run all the time.
How concerned are grid operators about intermittency issues posed by renewable energy? And do they have a plan for smoothing that out over time?
So grid operators in almost every region at this point have flagged some pretty serious concerns about what the next few years could look like as this pace of change increases. And so we have, in many respects, technology that can help with this issue in the form of battery storage. That being said, that technology is a bit limited right now. Battery storage remains a pretty small part of the electricity market, even though it's growing quickly. But the technology as it stands can't carry us collectively through a period in which there are very low supplies for whatever reason in any given region. So grid operators have raised concerns that we are going to need longer duration storage, essentially, to solve some of these issues. And so what we're looking at in the next few years, the potential for supply crunches in many regions as all of this has worked out.
I'm sure anyone who's experienced a severe blackout like the one in Texas understands the severity of this issue. But for the rest of us, what could these worsening grid problems actually look like in practice?
Yeah. So one thing that I found very striking in reporting this story is the New York grid operator has raised some near-term concerns about supplies as some conventional power plants go offline quite quickly and developers kind of scramble to build enough renewable energy sources as well as battery storage to offset that. But as we've seen, patterns are changing and they're changing in unforeseen ways many, many times. And they had cautioned that a 98-degree sustained heat wave could result in supply shortages in New York City as soon as next year, which is pretty remarkable. It is likely that outages are going to, you know, increase in frequency in the coming years, and they're very likely to be longer in duration. We're already beginning to see that. So federal government has been tracking sustained outages for the last 20 years or so, and it is remarkable to see how few there were back in 2000. Those numbers have increased pretty steadily over time.
And so what are grid operators doing about all of this?
So it's important to keep in mind that a lot of these changes are market-driven. You know, wind and solar generation is some of the cheapest forms of generation out there. Batteries are becoming increasingly cost-effective, and they're edging out conventional power plants in many regions. And in some places, that shift has been further accelerated by policy and regulations. The grid operator doesn't have direct control over what comes online and what goes offline. So these are not decisions that a grid operator is making. The grid operator is tasked with maintaining the balance of supply and demand and trying to ease any roadblocks that a developer might have in bringing new capacity online. And so they do have a lot of tools in their tool belt to be able to try to, you know, expedite some of these things and make sure that they're doing all they can to help address the problem. And many are. It's just, it's very complex. And what you're hearing from a lot of them is, let's make sure that we're managing the pace of change appropriately. Because if we're at a spot in which the retirement of conventional power plants has outpaced the amount of new capacity that we're able to add, that presents a real reliability concern.
And finally, Catherine, beyond grid level fixes, could we possibly see new technology more at the consumer level, adding some resiliency back into the grid?
Definitely. And you're beginning to see interest in that really surge in a lot of places that have had reliability issues. So to have, let's say, solar panels on your roof coupled with battery to store that power and to discharge it when you need it has been very useful for a lot of people. There are many people who would like to see us move more quickly toward a future like that in which generation doesn't have to just be large-scale wind and solar farms. It can be some of these smaller resources all being used to improve reliability. And we're getting there in some places. But some of the technology and the mechanisms needed to make this work within different markets is still developing. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out in the next couple of years.
That was Journal reporter Catherine Blunt. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And finally, the celebrity booze trend isn't new, as famous faces attach their likenesses to spirits amid an explosion of the micro distillery industry. But now, heavy metal bands are getting into the game, with the likes of Slipknot, Anthrax, and Motorhead all teaming up with whiskey brands. And as Journal reporter Trip Mickle explains, Metallica is getting especially hardcore with their liquor collaborations.
The Metallica guys, I mean, they're sonically enhancing their whiskey and bourbon barrels by playing their music at the barrels, which is causing them to vibrate. And Robert Trujillo, who is their bassist, has this vision and this dream, and he's trying to sell the band on putting a bunch of whiskey barrels on the stage at like Madison Square Garden and playing a live concert so that the whiskey is aged live at the show and then bottled and sold for fans who are like at the concert and avid collectors of everything Metallica.
I was skeptical at first, but it's Friday. Where can I get a sample? And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.